Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance here. We are live from the Kintec studio. 650. 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome details at DunbarLumber.com. All right, it's the Canucks versus the Islanders tonight. Now joining us to chat about that matchup and more from the Canadian Press, she is Gemma Karsten-Smith. Gemma, thank you as always for making some time for us. How are you?
Thanks so much for having me, guys. Good to talk to you.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. And how much Grey Cup stuff are you doing this week? Is this a very busy week for you with that?
Oh my gosh. It is a very busy week for me with that. I have to go cover a horse in a hotel tonight.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Please elaborate.
Do you not know about this? This is like an annual Grey Cup stunt.
Every
single year, they ride a horse into a hotel, and tonight my very important journalistic duty is to go cover this event.
So what does covering the horse in the hotel entail? Like
holding a video camera?
All right. What hotel is it?
I think. Holiday Inn downtown. I just hope it doesn't poop. That's all I'm asking.
That's got to be the best story, though, if it takes a big dump in the lobby.
Ugh. No, thanks.
It's not like it's your job to clean it up.
That's true.
Have fun with that. But also happening, the Canucks playing Bo Horvat and the New York Islanders. And from the Canucks' perspective tonight, obviously the big story is Dakota Joshua's return. And, you know, it's a great story purely from a personal perspective for Dakota Joshua, obviously coming back from battling testicular cancer. But from a hockey perspective, I mean, he was such a big part of the team's identity last year. And, you know, obviously they're winning games without him this year. But, I mean, how big a deal is it going to be for the Canucks to get Dakota Joshua and everything he brings back into the lineup?
It's huge. It's absolutely huge. He's a big body, right? He's such a massive presence, both physically and around that team, that I don't think he can do anything but add to that lineup. I think it'll obviously take him some time to get his feet back under him, get back up to game speed, but we've seen him practicing hard, and he said he didn't want to play again until he was ready to play his game. So we have to believe that he's there. I just think that he's got a lot to add to this lineup. He was such a good story for them last year. I think that he's been such a good find for this team. He's fit so well into Rick Tocchet's system that it's just going to add to the identity of this team.
Gemma, do you think Nils Höglander is in the doghouse?
Yes, I do. I don't think there's any way he couldn't be. He's been the invisible man so far this season. And when you have noticed him, it hasn't been for the right reasons. So I think that exasperated is probably the best word to describe how Rick Tocchet feels about him right now. He's just like, what do I do with this kid? So, and I don't think that's necessarily, I think a lot of that has to do with the style Höglander plays, and he's kind of like the opposite of Joshua in a way. He can't fit into Tocchet's system as seamlessly as a guy like Joshua can, just because of his skill set and his frame. And at this point, I think the coach is just trying to figure out, like, I've tried so much with this kid, I don't know what else to do with him. So that's where the Höglander story lies.
Is it surprising for you, Gemma, because, you know, you go back to training camp, right? And he has a new extension 3 years after this one at $3 million, and the Tocchet's raving about, you know, how he comes into shape and his work ethic. And then even early in the year, right, he's playing way more minutes than we saw him play last year. And it just feels like it's turned sour really, really quickly here in a short period of time for Nils Höglander.
Totally. We're only, what, 14 games in the season? And like I said, he's essentially disappeared. Like, he's just, it's not, I don't know what's happened to his game. He's just, I cannot remember seeing him make a play that I was like, ooh, very nice, in the last, what, 8 games? Mm-hmm. That's a lot. So, like you said, he came in so in shape. He came in, he had 24 even strength goals last year. Like, it's, he's had such success in the past with Tockett, that you believe that there was something to build on. But I just think that the way this team is built right now with the other pieces, there's a glut of forwards, especially with Joshua coming back. And someone's going to get pushed out. It looks like Hoglander's that guy.
Yeah, and it's a weird situation, too, because, I mean, on the one hand, we kind of have the playbook for what it looks like when a forward is in Rick Tockett's doghouse, right? And you go back to Andre Kuzmenko, and we all know what happened there. Daniel Sprong is out of town, right? So we've kind of seen it before, but it also doesn't feel like, given the investment they made in Hoglander and the success he had last year, like it doesn't seem like that's a straightforward solution either. So I feel like it's going to be a little awkward here, especially, as you said, because of the depth this team has up front. You know, if Joshua's back, if eventually Brock Besser's back, if Lekkerimäki continues to establish himself, like that's going to be a pretty tough spot for Nils Hoglander minutes-wise.
For sure. And I don't think, like, I don't see him being sent down to the AHL. So does he just come join us in the press box? I don't know what the answer is, but I don't know. He doesn't have a natural fit in this lineup, and I don't see one magically becoming available, barring injuries, and let's all knock on wood that doesn't happen, because we all hate to see guys injured. So I don't know what the answer is for him going forward, but it doesn't seem like the answer is within this particular configuration of players. I guess that would suggest that the answer is he finds a home with another team, and wouldn't that be a nice trade piece to have? But I don't know how many teams are looking for Nils Hoglander at this point of the season.
Gemma, what were your impressions of Jonathan Lekkerimäki's debut and the fact that they're going right back to him in sort of a top-of-the-lineup role tonight?
Totally. I think he was impressive, right? And that's that was what everyone said, and that's what we saw. He created chances, but he didn't end the night with the puck in the net, but he was noticeable. He played the game the way that Tockett likes to see it played. Even when he had that big turnover, Tockett went back to him. And so he obviously has seen enough from him in practice that he trusts him, and wouldn't make that mistake again, right? Like, he's a young kid who has a lot of skill, and we saw that, but he's also learning. Right? And that's what Tockett wants. He wants a guy who's going to be able to adapt to the system and be able to play the game the Canucks way. So I think that that's what we're seeing so far.
Well, and I thought the most impressive thing for Lekkerimäki might have been the praise that he got from Rick Tockett after the game, right? Like talking about, hey, he's got a defensive conscience, and we know how much that means coming from Rick Tockett, right? Like, we were just talking about Nils Hoglander and the struggles there and everything. If Tockett is convinced that you have that buy-in and you're putting forth that effort, the requisite effort on defense, I think that goes a long way, and more than even the playmaking or anything like that, which is obviously important. I mean, I think that bodes pretty well for Lekkerimäki being able to carve out a role at the NHL level if he's already getting praise like that from Tockett.
Exactly. Exactly. I think that's the thing that we didn't see from Sprong, right? Like, Tockett talked a lot about Sprong's offensive ability, but he said that he had to improve on defense and be trustworthy in all scenarios. And that's just never happened. So, and now look where Sprong is. He's back in Seattle. Mm-hmm. So I think that these are all good things to see from a young player in his debut. Let's hope that he can keep it up moving forward, because there's going to be a lot of different kinds of games, a lot of different kinds of nights, and they're not all going to be shiny and pretty and positive, right?
What do you make of Bo Horvat's return? Is this a storyline that still has juice?
I don't know.
That's a no, I think.
I believe that is a emphatic no. I mean, Bo's a really nice guy. I think that everyone who's playing against him, though, on the Canucks is over it, to be quite frank. I don't think it's I think the fans in the stands will care a lot more than the guys on the ice. How's that?
Yeah, I think that's probably fair. When you think about that deal, right, how do you grade it? Do you grade it as a clear win for Vancouver, a deal that's made sense for both teams? How do you sort of regard it historically?
I think that you have to take into account what Horvat got paid in New York. That's not a deal he could have had here, right? And it's just not a deal he would have got here. So I think that in that regard, yes, it's a deal that made sense on both sides. I think that the return was what it was. It was what they could get at the time for a pending UFA. And I don't know that that's what you would ask. I think you would ask more today, but that's just hindsight, right? It's just 50-50. You look at Ratu, he's still here now. He's making improvements with the club. He'll be in the lineup tonight, it looks like. So I think that the lingering impact of that deal is still with Vancouver. So I don't know that you can ask for a whole lot more than that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I look at it as it's fundamentally just a deal they kind of had to make, right? Like they would have had so much money tied up at center otherwise, and you know they needed to find a defenseman. And look, can you quibble with some aspects of the return? And I don't think the Islanders are choked about it, but ultimately it seems like it made a lot of sense for both sides. And you know, the Canucks have been really good since they made that trade, so that helps a lot as well to make it a whole lot easier. The other player I wanted to ask you about, Gemma, who of course has been very, very much front and center in the spotlight, a lot of conversation about them this year, is Elias Pettersson. And, you know, just over the last couple of games, that conversation has started to turn in more of a positive direction. He's got 4 points in his last two games. I thought the last one against Calgary, probably his best game of the season, but I also think it's fair to say, you know, he's not all the way back to being the old Elias Pettersson. Is it real? Like, do you see enough over the last couple of games that it's at least significant progress in that direction based on your view?
I definitely do. I think I'm becoming a Pettersson stan.
All right.
If that's possible. Like, I believe in him.
A Pettersson slappy?
What is that? What does that mean?
What do you mean?
What's a slappy?
A slappy is like the evolved version of Stan, like someone who's
like even more than a Stan?
Yeah, yeah, like slappy.
Evolved like Pokemon?
Yeah, pretty much. Slappy.
I've never heard that before.
Wow.
Gemma, did you know that?
The more you know.
Wow.
the reading rainbow, you guys. Anyway, I think that he maybe... We're just seeing the same thing that we've seen the last few seasons of Pettersson, is that he gets off to a slow start and finds his game and then he plays really darn well. So I believe in him. I think he's going to do great. I stick by my prediction of him having 100-plus points this season.
Oh, wow. All right. So you're looking for him to really go nuke over the rest of the season.
I'm doubling down, guys. I am slappy happy.
Slappy. So it's Slappy is the character from SpongeBob. Right?
Oh.
Who is a always supports Pearl. And so a slappy. Yeah, I can't believe you guys don't know this.
I don't know that. No.
Okay, well, you should watch
more. Not a big SpongeBob guy.
You should watch more SpongeBob.
Watch more SpongeBob.
Apparently.
Is that what you're saying?
Sorry, I thought you.
Oh,
I thought,
I'm sorry. Are you telling the two people with small children that they should watch more cartoons?
Watch more cartoons?
I wouldn't say you should watch more cartoons. Just get your priorities in order, guys.
Booing you out.
Anyways, I'm glad you're doubling down, Gemma. That's what sports radio is all about.
Yeah.
Take the hot take, double down. Don't let the evidence dissuade you. Just stick with it.
Thanks, guys.
So where are you at? We're sort of at this interesting point in the season. The Canucks will play game 15 tonight. Game 15 is always a nice round number. We're halfway to the point where I like to start to say that we have a good handle on what a team is. What is this team to you at this point? What are you seeing, generally speaking, from the Canucks as they approach game 15 this evening?
I'm still seeing an inconsistent team. Mm-hmm. I think that it depends on which version of the Canucks shows up on any given night. I think that the team you saw against Calgary on what day was that? Monday? I think that team is a lot different than the team that we saw against New Jersey a few weeks ago.
Mm-hmm.
It depends a lot on who decides to come play, right? What version of their defense they're going to put out there. So I think on a good night, you're seeing a team that can compete for top in the Pacific Division. And that's saying a lot because I think that the Oilers will get their together at some point. But I think they have to maintain that and show us that they can maintain that for more than three games through California. So if that ever comes to be, then this team is a force to be reckoned with. And if it's not, then there's going to be trouble down the stretch.
Gemma, really appreciate it. And have fun with the horse. I hope he gives you a really good quote. I hope something exciting happens with the horse in the hotel.
I'll keep you guys posted. Nay.
I'll look out for the Canadian press story about it. The big headline.
I'm a big horse slappy. Just want you to know.
Oh my gosh. This has gone off the rails.
Don't slap a horse. That's cruel. Anyways, thank you, Gemma.
Bye, friends.
That is Gemma Karsten-Smith from the Canadian Press covering the Canucks and also the Grey Cup and the horse-related activities at the Grey Cup. Somebody texted in, I just tuned in. What's going to be so exciting about Jason Brough walking through a hotel lobby?
Oh, my God.
Well done. Pretty good.
Very well done.
Pretty good. That's a good text.
Did you also see we got a text in from someone who calculated mean point percentage last season, which I just absolutely love. So if you add all cumulative point percentage from last year and divide by 32, the average is 0.552.
Mm-hmm. So a 550 was average. 552.
So 550 is average.
Which the other thing that this is, I was thinking about this, and it's when you actually step back and think about it, is wild.
It's 91 point pace.
But the crazy thing about this is that it's not, that won't be the same every year.
No.
Because there's a different number of points awarded every year.
Yeah,
because there's a different number of overtime games. That's wild. When you really think about that, it's like, you can't say, well, this will be the average because you have no idea how many 3-point games there's going to be.
The NHL standings are completely broken.
They really are.
They're so bad. They're so bad. And that's why we cannot abide by things like a team that's won 6 of 16 is 500. They're not even close to 500. It's ridiculous.
Oh, they're 2 games off. That's close.
It's not even close.
Not even close. I don't know about that.
It's not even close. 6 of 16, man? They've won 37% of their games.
Yeah, it's not great.
It's more like a third. It's materially not close.
It's closer to, well, it's the same distance from a quarter as it is to half.
Right.
Yeah.
It is.
It is.
Yes, you're right.
It's exactly 12 and a half.
So it is absolutely, unequivocally not 500.
Somebody else, I missed this one as well, but when we were talking about the horse, texted and tell Brough I said hi. So multiple independent Jason Brough is a horse text coming in as soon as Gemma mentioned that she was going to cover the horse for the CFL.
Brilliant.
650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. And we
is
got
it
a
like
few questions
Nay
coming
Cup?
In.
The Nay Cup
the
event?
Nay Cup. Yeah. I don't know about that one.
You're out on that?
I'm thinking about it, and
you thought about it, you're like,
and I'm like, no,
you
thank
thought
you.
About it, you were like, hey, I don't like that joke.
Not for me.
All right, gallop on.
Mike, the urologist from Brockville, says, question I've saved for you smart guys. Well, thank you for the flattery, Mike. What is the impact on the player salaries from being moved up and down from the AHL so much? Is Arshdeep Bains losing tons of dough? The answer is yes, right? If you're on a two-way deal, you make less money in the AHL than you do in the NHL. And it's, as you said, you know, these aren't like fake transactions. These are real transactions. You're being assigned to the AHL. You're spending a day in the AHL. And that comes with the corresponding salary loss, right?
Yeah. No, it's not a paper transaction. There are paper transactions in the NHL, but these moves that the Canucks are making are not paper transactions, even though the players no longer have to report directly to Abbotsford and don't have to move, there are meaningful implications. The only paper transactions in the NHL happen at the trade deadline,
mm-hmm.
when players are papered down, and that's how it's referred to, papered down to the American League to preserve their Calder Cup eligibility. They also come right back. So that's it. That's the only variety of paper transaction. So stop calling it that.
Yeah. But
stop calling it 500. Precision matters.
The point about the lost income, the lost salary for the players, it is a, you know, an interesting one to consider as the team tries to get really aggressive about this, right?
Sure.
Or like it's a, you know, from the player's perspective, you kind of understand, like you know, how angry can you be ultimately? But there's an element of, you know, you have to manage the relationship and everything here. You have to make sure everyone's on board, all of those things. And it might even be a constraining factor. Does it stop you from getting, you know, as aggressive as you possibly could at certain points? Who knows? But yeah, it's not just theoretical for these guys. It is costing them money to be doing the, you know, Abbotsford to Vancouver shuffle week after week after week in the case of guys like Atu Ratu and Arshdeep Bains, and Bains remaining down with Abbotsford for right now. Billy in Port Moody texts in, what would Drance's preferred point system in the NHL be?
I mean, my preferred point system would include ties. So, like, I just don't like shootouts. I don't think they add much. But in a world where you want to have... I mean, I don't even like overtime. To be totally honest with you at this point, like, the way that they play overtime now is brutal.
Yeah, it's not as good.
Like, it's not interesting. 3-on-3, I, like, dread it now. You know, at first, it was like, oh, man, this is sick. But now that it's, like, possession game, like, how many times do I really want to watch teams, like, reload by skating the puck outside the blue line? It's such a catastrophe. So, honestly, at this point, I'd like to see teams go back to what it was when in my day. Which is 5 minutes of overtime that is just normal hockey. Play 5 minutes of overtime that's just normal hockey, and then accept the tie. To me, that's how I'd like to see it. And I'd like to see 3 points for a regulation loss, 2 for a win after regulation, and then, well, I guess if you have ties, then you can have 2 points for a win.
Yeah.
One
zero,
for a tie.
And get rid of the overtime.
But I do think it's fun to have some sort of meaningful incentive for teams to go for it, because the one thing I hate that you get in the NHL is, like, no one takes chances in the last 5 minutes of a tied game in the third period.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sucks. You know, it's fun watching, like, a minnow hold on for dear life in soccer, for example, because they're pushing, like, against the superior team because they're pushing. Like, it's fun to have a team playing like they're trailing late in the game, especially because those are, you'll more often see it from, like, the very good teams, right? Or, like, pushing when they're tied to win the game in regulation. So I'd like to find some way of rewarding that. So maybe it is a 3 points for a regulation victory. You go 2-1. If it's an overtime decision. But I'd like to see every point, every game have the same number of points.
Yes, that's the big one for me.
Yeah, and I want to see some sort of incentive so that you don't get those gentlemen's agreement last 5 minutes where both teams are just like, take the point. We'll take the point and manage your losses.
Yeah.
Why do we talk about managing our losses? I hate it.
There is a part of me that's just like, no points for going to overtime. Just wins and losses.
Yeah, I'm okay.
You know what I mean?
I get that, and I'm okay with it. It's better than what we have, but I do like the incentive to win in regulation.
I get that. I understand that. And
at the very least, it should be a tiebreaker. You know, like, at the very least, it should be something you record.
That counts
in the
standings.
So, I mean, I'd put it this way. I don't have, like, a perfect answer or, like, one way that it should be done. I just know that the current way creates bad incentives, doesn't make sense mathematically. And to top it all off, the stuff that the league has designed to be, like, fun for fans is, like, dreadful. Dreadfully boring now. I don't like the shootout, and I don't like the 3-on-3 overtime. So, I mean, that needs to change. You shouldn't be allowed to, if you carry the puck outside the zone, I think, at 3-on-3, there should be a penalty. I think they have to do something to change that if they're going to keep the current system, because 3-on-3 is irrevocably broken. It's literally bad to watch. I hate watching it.
Yeah, the good ones are few and far between now.
Methodical. I'd way rather watch San Jose Philadelphia. Well, this is a good game. It was an entertaining one the other day.
All right, we'll take a break here. It is a Canucks game day. They're taking on Bo Horvat and the New York Islanders. Dakota Joshua making his return. We will hear from head coach Rick Tocchet in the next segment here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here, live from the Kintech studio. Kintech, Canada's favorite orthotics provider, powered by thousands of five-star Google reviews. Sore feet? What are you waiting for? 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. It is Canucks game day. They're taking on the New York Islanders at Rogers Arena tonight as they continue this lengthy homestand at Rogers Arena. And as mentioned, lots going on. Dakota Joshua return. Lekker Mackey's still in the lineup. So let's hear from Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet.
Well, it's like making a major trade. He's a big kid that's got great hands. Obviously, he's played really well for this organization, especially last year. So we're really excited to have him back. He's gone through a lot of stuff, and I've loved the way he's dealt with it. And, we're just happy for him.
I know you're excited to get his skill back out on the ice, but what does it add to the dressing room as well?
Well, he's a well-liked kid. He's turned into a leader, too. He's got a big voice. So, it's like I said, it's a major thing for us right now.
I know you talked about Lincoln and a lot, but he's been such a key guy for you. Can you just, the things that he, not only the saves he makes, but maybe that trickles down throughout your game, that he doesn't let in bad ones, it seems like, you know, to stop him.
Yeah, I mean, you guys see like how he's in the game. He's obviously played awesome for us, but it's even not even the game, it's the day-to-day preparation, practices. He's there early today watching video by himself. Another well-liked guy that, guys want to do well in front of him. So, he's a stay-in-the-moment guy. I think you guys told you a couple weeks ago, I don't even know if he knows who we play next game. He just knows that he's got the Islanders tonight, and that's all he thinks about, and he'll worry about practice tomorrow. That's what I love about the guy.
You think, here's a guy who had an opportunity to kind of grab the ball, whatever that saying is. What does it say about guys like that? I mean, coaches must love guys who grasp opportunity.
Yeah, I mean, you root for guys like that. Was a week into camp, and he's not on a team yet, and he comes late to camp, and I'm sure he's going to be whoever's going to be. I hope it's us, but he's going to do well next year. So that if he continues on this path.
What about the opportunity for Lekker Mackey, the bumper on that power play? Yeah. Like, obviously, he's a shooter, right?
Right.
So is the instruction just to fire away?
Well, I think when you have a guy that talented like Besser. The PK, I mean, you got to look, Islanders probably don't know much about him, but he's a guy that you give him just a second with a puck, it can be in the net. And when you have those bumpers like Bo Horvat, like he's another one of those guys, especially when he was here, they're tough to defend because they just need a second and it's off their stick in the net. So, Johnny's trending that way with his talent.
Ratu, a young player that obviously the Islanders saw a lot of value in, and you guys did as well when made the trade for Bo Horvat. How have you seen him kind of come into his own, and what do you think he can do impact-wise for your group?
Well, his work ethic is outstanding. I've never seen a young kid work as hard as he is. Now, there's some parts of his game he wants to go so hard all the time that he's got to slow the game down. That's probably his only thing that he's got to learn, and that comes with experience and maturity. I'm not worried about that, but his work ethic is something that you can't, you got to bottle, because that guy's, he's the first guy on the ice, last one off the ice, so I'm really happy about his work ethic.
You had such high praise for Hoglander in training camp, the way he reported. He started all right. He's in a bit of a rut right now, obviously, and only played 9.5 minutes the other night. Where is he? Where are you with his game?
Yeah, I have to take some responsibility with that, because I think I got to get him out there. I think he needs a few more minutes. Has he made some tough decisions that I have not liked without the puck? But he's a kid that... I got to take responsibility. I got to coach him better. I think it's on me to get him out there more often. And he's a guy, he came up to me this morning, to be quite frankly, honestly, he goes, "Talk, I'm not playing good for you." And I told him, "Well, I got to get you more ice time." So I think it's a give and take. I got to get him out there tonight, because I think he's going to play with Dakota tonight. And he's going to have a good player to play with that they can, work the corners against. And that's what Hoggy is. He's a buzz, he's a buzzsaw around the net.
Islanders are a team that have had some trouble closing games out. They've played a ton in overtime. As a coach, if you get to that point in a game in the third period where you're down a couple or you're close, is that something that you mention to your group if a team has struggled to close games out?
Well, I think it's hard as a coach, because you always want to take the lead and stuff like that. But I think you don't want to make people nervous out there. I think you got to be careful. you know, when you teach that sort of stuff to players and let things happen. But you have to make teams aware of it. You know, you make your team aware of it. I mean, I don't know, I've watched the game. The others are, you know, on a bit of a roll. I thought, you know, they're a solid team. I mean, they're a dangerous team. That's the way, like, they've always have been. They got some really good veteran players that know how to play the game. So, yeah, it's a tough team to play against.
We saw Brock and Hall here in sweats. I mean, I know we ask every day, but like, just the fact that he's back and around the group and stuff, like, is this any sort of positive development?
Or? Yeah, I think, honestly, it's a, and I don't want to say day-to-day thing, because, but I look at it with those type of things, it's how do you feel? You know, some days, you know, you grab a couple of percent better, like, you know, might be only a percentage at a time, but any positive day is a good day for him.
That is Canucks head coach Rick Tocchet with his thoughts about the game tonight against the Islanders, and just a quick little commentary on Brock Besser towards the end there. And a bunch of things stand out from Rick Tocchet there. You know, obviously you can tell how much he is excited to get Dakota Joshua back. You just listen to the language he's using, right? Like, he's gone through a lot of stuff, and I love the way he's dealt with it, talking about how well-liked he is in the room. He's turned into a leader. He's got a big voice. Talk it, not downplaying at all what a big deal it is for the team, for the mood of the team, for all of that, to have, you know, not a core player, but something close, like a really important player, an identity player back in the lineup.
Yeah. Dakota Joshua's really good, man.
Yeah.
Like, he's just a really good player and does some really unique things for this club that they've clearly been missing. Also, we talked about how in some instances the Vancouver attendees, the fans at games, have not been as sharp this season as this hockey mad city usually is. Tonight's a big opportunity, though. You know, when Dakota Joshua gets on the ice for his first shift, tonight's a big opportunity, I think, to make good. I mean, this is a guy who deserves a huge reception,
yep,
given what he's been through over the past few months.
And he will get it.
And he will get it.
Yeah.
But it's going to be awesome.
It'll be very awesome.
Yeah.
It'll be really cool. Yeah, it'll be absolutely fantastic. And so, yeah, no surprise that Tocchet is really excited and, you know, really looking forward to having Joshua back at his disposal. The other player of note there that Rick Tocchet was talking about was Nils Höglander, right? And some really interesting commentary from Tocchet on Höglander, right? Saying, you know, and this is something we've heard before from Rick Tocchet, right? Like, he demands a lot of accountability from his players, but I think Tocchet is also pretty quick to take accountability for himself, right? Like, how many times about different things, whether it's a specific player or a systems issue or something, has Rick Tocchet said, hey, that's on me. I've got to be better at that. I can do a better job on that. It's happened pretty regularly, right? And I think that's a big deal, and it happens again here, right, where he's saying, I got to take responsibility on Höglander. I can coach him better. I can get him out there more often. And even pulling back the curtain a little bit and telling us that, yeah, Höglander approached him and basically said, look, I know I'm not giving you good minutes right now. And Tocchet said, well, yeah, but I got to get you out there more as well. So, you know, just another kind of glimpse into the way that Rick Tocchet goes about building relationships and managing these relationships. But sounds like a pretty productive,
yeah, that's a healthy
commentary between the two players,
totally,
or the two parties.
Yeah, like, hey, I'm not playing well for you. Hey, I need to get you more minutes.
Yep.
They're both right,
yep,
to some extent, right? So, no, I think that's a sign of health, healthy communication. And I promise you this, too. Höglander taking the initiative and going up to Tocchet and sort of having the conversation, I guarantee you the Canucks coach likes that. And then, look, that's always been the case with Höglander, right? Like, the work ethic stuff, the skill level, the motor, right? Like, this is not what we saw with Bruce Boudreau, right? Where
Boudreau didn't really have time for him.
Correct.
Yeah.
This is, and it never has been, even though Höglander has been a healthy scratch in the playoffs and has struggled to take that next step, that breakout step where he cements himself as a top six player for the Canucks. And, you know, it's one of the reasons I don't really buy the Höglander as trade chip talk, to be totally honest with you. Like, Höglander was flat out not available when the Canucks were shopping for big ticket items at the trade deadline last year. They extended him before the season.
Since then, they extended him. Yeah.
So, yeah. So, like, just go through that, because choices tell us more than commentary does, right? The Canucks chose not to offer Nils Höglander while chasing big ticket items at the trade deadline last season. Okay. They then healthy scratched him in the playoffs. And then when he came to camp and was in phenomenal shape and looked like he'd had a huge summer, the club extended him prior to the season beginning. Does that sound like a guy the Canucks are going to be motivated to trade for a second pair upgrade on an expiring deal? Like, no chance. No chance. This club's very, very high on this player. Now, they need to sort through some things to make sure they get the most of him. He obviously also needs to sort through some things in his game so that he can get to the point where he's playing enough minutes.
Yep.
Which, you know, we talked about this before the season. The idea that what does a Hoglander breakout look like? It doesn't look like 30 goals. It looks like 15 minutes a night.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we've seen sort of a mixed result through 14 games. Seven games where he was a top six forward, minutes. Super yep. productive, looked really good defensively, and then seven games where he's been a peripheral contributor.
Yeah.
And so, you know, it's on him to sort of grab those reins and figure it out. And yeah, it's on Tocchet to give him a path back to a larger role here too, right? And I think that's what that conversation reflects. I think that's healthy communication. So I love to hear that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, I think at this point we understand Tocchet's really good at communicating with his players and managing those relationships.
But you think, reading between the lines, you do sort of think
well,
that it's...
Here's what I'll say, because you're absolutely right about, hey, they didn't want to trade him. They gave him the extension. The extension's the huge thing, right? You don't extend...
Oh, I think the fact that he, like, literally wasn't available
sure.
in talks
but,
for
like,
big-ticket
generally
items
speaking,
is
generally like, speaking, what do we always say whenever a player signs a contract, you know, leading up to the trade deadline anywhere around the league? It's like, well, take somebody off the trade list, right? Because
right.
teams extend players because they don't want to trade them. That's
correct.
Generally how it works. So like, that was a pretty big signal, and I even felt, you know, because I agree with what you're saying from that perspective, but I had felt through those first seven games that he had earned himself a bit of a longer leash, right? That it was like, okay, he's really established himself. Mm-hmm. I think I used the phrase in Rick Tocchet's circle of trust. I was not expecting him to be back on the outside of that circle so quickly.
Yeah, off of like one ugly back check.
Yeah, and I will say, ultimately, I think your analysis is correct here, right? That there he's not trade bait from the organization's perspective. However, my ears did perk up hearing Rick Tocchet do the thing where he's like, hey, I've got to take responsibility for Hoglander. I can coach him better, because I haven't had time to go back, you know, a couple of years into the transcripts of Rick Tocchet availabilities, but like, I'm pretty sure he said those exact same things about Andre Kuzmenko, right? Now, that doesn't mean it's going to play out in exactly the same way, but I think it is indicative sometimes of, yeah, it hasn't been a clean fit. The relationship, not the relationship in terms of like their interpersonal relationship, but the hockey relationship is not working out how either side wants it. So look, that doesn't mean he's going to get traded. That doesn't mean he's trade bait, but it definitely caught my ears. Just again, that's pretty similar language to what we heard from Rick Tocchet about Andre Kuzmenko a couple times.
The Rick Tocchet equivalent to the vote of confidence for a head coach?
Yes. Right? And it's like, oh, that's not good. I know he said it was a vote of confidence, but uh-oh.
Rick talking out there being like, he's got really good hands for a big guy. And just like going deep into the lexicon of backhanded hockey compliments.
The other thing I want to get into with Hoglander, and part of the reason this is a complicated discussion, and this text comes in unsigned, where do you see him long-term in the lineup? And I do think there's an important distinction to be made short-term this season and long-term going forward for Nils Hoglander. Short-term this season, if you get Brock Besser back and Dakota Joshua sticks in the lineup and Lucker Mackey sticks in the lineup and Nils Hoglander is relegated to a fourth-line role, okay, you're trying to win the Stanley Cup. You've got a good player on the fourth line. You can deal with that. If everything else is working out, that's fine. Long-term, do you want a player that you just signed to a $3 million AAV deal stuck in a fourth-line role? Or do you want a path to a bigger role for them? You definitely want a path to a bigger role for them. And I think it is a legitimate question, you know, having invested in Jake DeBrusk, right? You know, Connor Garland obviously is playing so well for the team. He's got another year on his deal. We'll see what happens with Brock Besser.
Big decision to make on Besser at yeah. some point in the near future, yeah.
What does that pathway beyond this year look like for Hoglander? If it's a fourth-line role this year for Hoglander, but he's playing well and the team is playing well, that's fine. You can live with that. In some ways, that's a great problem to have. Beyond that, I don't know what the pathway to regular top 6 minutes for Nils Hoglander is, and I think it's a valid question at this point.
Yeah. Well, the thing is, though, is you don't have to design it. You know, like that would be
yeah,
my...
Yeah, you can wait and see what happens.
Well, also that if a player belongs in top six deployment, they're going to get, they're going to end up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like, I've never really bought the, you're blocking
you have
a young
to leave
player.
A spot open.
Yeah, no, like players force your hand, right? If mm-hmm. you don't have to leave a spot open, a guy will kick the door down. This is the NHL. You know, like that you have to be accelerating and improving and maintaining at such a preposterous level, because there's always 15, 20-year-old players ready to take your job. That's
yep.
That's the nature of competitive enterprise. It's the nature of competitive sports. So, you know, who knows what the future brings, right? There's injuries that happen that open a space on a top line. There's a losing streak that happens, and then, you know, a coach is just like, I wonder if Alex Burrows would work with the Twins. Mm-hmm. Like, things happen and then snowball. Whole careers get made out of it, right? And the truth of the matter is not, well, Alex Burrows was lucky that the Canucks went on a losing streak and he got that job. It was Alex Burrows was ready and good, and the moment he got that opportunity, he didn't relinquish it for 10 years, right? That's the nature of this business. That's the nature of this game. So, you know, who knows what happens with Besser's next contract, right? Who knows who's healthy in yep. the playoffs and what Hoglander can do if he's one of the guys who's given the opportunity. The point isn't about what his path looks like. The point is whether or not he's going to be prepared to take advantage of the shot when it comes, because it's inevitable that it'll come.
And has he done enough to put his play in a position where he can earn the trust at that point? Right. Mm. Like when that opportunity comes, is he seen as a legitimate long term option, or is he seen as a stopgap option at that point by Rick Tocchet and the coaching staff? Right.
Yes.
That's the major question. And I think it's an unanswered question at this point. I kind of thought it had been answered, which is part of the reason why I'm pretty surprised. And and I think that's part of the reason why I see maybe a little bit more uncertainty in the situation than you do, just because I was like, I thought this was kind of done and dusted and put away. But now we're having this conversation again with Nils Höglander. Part of it is the depth of the team, but part of it is, for whatever reason, just hasn't clicked for Höglander consistently under Tocchet.
Yeah, and I suppose there is a sort of affiliated question or a question that comes from this too, mm-hmm. which is that a lot of what we know and a lot of the evidence that I presented, those are management decisions.
Yes.
A lot of our underlying concerns are coaching decisions.
Yep.
Now, again, I don't believe that this is like with Boudreau, where Boudreau was scratching Höglander and where management was actually like, that was like a major source of friction. Now, there were a lot of major sources of friction. But that was a major source of friction between certainly Patrick Alvin and Boudreau during Boudreau's tenure, for sure. But so I don't think it's like that, right? Because I just don't. Everything I know about how these folks interact, current Canucks management, is like there are often disagreements, right? And often skepticism about one thing or another. But generally, it's like, okay, well, if you feel this way, let's give it some time. Let's see how it works. Let's let it
from
play
everything
out.
We can see on the outside, it seems like the working relationship, and no surprise, they brought him in, is
super
extremely
strong.
Healthy and,
super
and positive.
Yeah. But there, you know, like I think the big defender thing, right, is a perfect example where the organization brought in these big defenders like Desharnais, right, Forbert, on and on, and it was like, okay, well, if you think we can win this way, let's see. Let's see. We're going to probably buy on the back end at some point anyway. We're going to keep our powder dry to buy on the back end at some point anyway. Let's see what it looks like. You know, and maybe it doesn't work and we'll have to modify how we're playing with some of these guys on the ice. But by Christmas, we're going to have a good sense of it and then we're going to make a final decision.
Yeah.
You know, I honestly think Daniel Sprong's another good example where the club wanted to take, certainly, I think Tocchet wanted to take a big swing to add another right-handed scorer for the power play. I think this is a big reason why Garland keeps getting onto PP1, right? Sprong couldn't hack it, couldn't build that trust. But, you know, what part of the, again, should we take a big swing on a scoring forward? No, let's take a smaller swing and preserve our flexibility, but we'll get a guy with upside to maybe fill that role.
Yep.
Didn't work out. So that's sort of something that I'm going to be looking for now, right? Is like a right-handed scoring winger, right-handed center, right? Like Tkachuk doesn't have everything he probably wants in terms of this roster. He doesn't have a right-handed faceoff winner, right? So there's always this push and pull in a hard cap system as you go about team building. I don't detect any signs of like a disagreement substantive enough to cause actual friction. It's just about smart people getting together and disagreeing and trying to make the best decisions as a group.
Mm-hmm.
But I do think the Hoglander one could get interesting if we don't see his role rebound in time, or if another key forward gets hurt and Hoglander doesn't get a look, or what have you. If this sort of continues to snowball, then I do think that's going to be at least a somewhat relevant question. Here, I'll add one more for you, Jamie.
Sure.
Hoglander's playing with Dakota Joshua tonight. How many years Garland has left on his deal? Two?
Mm-hmm.
This year and next?
Yep.
And he's probably going to be, he's probably going to earn himself a raise with another 60-point season.
Keeps playing like this, yeah.
So, you know, there's a relatively straightforward path to the top nine,
mm-hmm.
right? Hoglander and Garland have some similarities as players, right? So, you know, even tonight, even if he's in a more limited role, like, there's still opportunity. It's not about carving it out for him. It's about him seizing it.
And I think the other thing here is, again, one of the key differences between the Kuzmenko situation last year and Hoglander right now is with Kuzmenko, it was this guy, what was he making, 5.9? 5.9 million. And it was the coach does not want to play him. Not even just wants to play him in a fourth line role, but just like does not want to play him. And you're going to need to move that money if you want to make an addition anywhere else. Right. So it was like the Kuzmenko situation was untenable for a team with designs on a long playoff run. You just could not commit that much of the cap to a player that the coach had no time for. Right. It was untenable. Hoglander's situation is not untenable this year. He's making 1.1. No. So again, it's like, okay, well, he's a fourth liner for us. That's not ideal. We'd like him to take those next steps, but it's like, okay, he's making 1.1 million and he's on your fourth line. That's totally tenable. That's fine. You can live with that and figure more out down the road. So that's a key difference with the Kuzmenko situation.
Yeah, and I suppose there's some, you know, like based on Elliot Friedman's reporting, for example, about what Pittsburgh's looking for in trading their veterans. Like, mm-hmm. if you wanted Marcus Pettersson for Nils Höglander, I think you could get that done tomorrow.
Yes.
If you were, now, you'd have to figure out a couple things cap-wise from a Canucks perspective, but that's rounding errors. This club could figure that out somewhat straightforward fashion. There's no way that's worth doing for an expiring 28-year-old. No.
Who's not a home run.
Needle mover.
Yeah.
And whose fit is sort of interesting. So, look, we'll sort of see how this sorts itself out, but I don't think the Kuzmenko thing is at all analogous, and partly, too, because one of the reasons that the Kuzmenko thing went sour so quickly was it became a distraction,
mm-hmm.
right? It became something that people were grumbling about on the team itself. Internally, people were grumbling about his usage and the patience, and it was, like, impossible. It had become impossible for Tkachuk to put him out at a greater level ice time wise because of how other players, other coaches, Tkachuk himself reacted to it. Like, that we're nowhere close to that with Hoglander.
No, absolutely not. There's some similarities, but yeah, again, it ultimately is very different.
And
than
based
that.
On work ethic and personality, we'll probably never be there with Hoglander. So I think it's fair to sort of draw a line between them from a, hey, it can be hard in terms of how good you have to play defensively to carve out a big minute role under Tkachuk. Like, that's fair, I think. But there's no similarity real. Like, in terms of the actual texture of this, it's totally different than it was with Kuzmenko.
Okay, we're going to take a break here. Final segment coming up. We got an open segment here. So send your texts and questions in. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. We'll try to read some of them on the other side here. Final segment of Canucks Talk next. Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drance. We're live from the Kintec studio. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. The Bridge Street Dunbar Lumber in Ladner has moved to Progress Way in Tilbury's Industrial Park. More room, more product, more awesome details at DunbarLumber.com. Send your text in to the Dunbar Lumber text line. I've got one I want to read here. You look like, do you have something to say?
No.
Shifting in your chair? Okay.
I'm in a group chat with like some random Canucks fans, and one of them mentioned that I better join Blue Sky before someone steals my handle.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, ah, you're right. So then I'm now panic joining Blue Sky. I'm not going to use it.
You got to at least squat on that.
I'm not going to use it, but I'm going to squat on it for a minute.
Yeah. I've had, not that I'm like a Twitter power user or anything, but I've had a Blue Sky account.
Not that I'm a Twitter power user.
I'm not.
You could be.
It's not for me. I don't know. Anyways, I've had one for like a year, but I haven't used it at all. But I was just like, look, I'm just going to be where the people are. I'm going to be where the most people are, where people are like tweeting about hockey and stuff. That's where I'm going to be. If we decide that's Blue Sky, that's great. If we stick with Twitter, okay, fine. I'll stay there as well. All right, 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. BGB texted in. It seems strange that with the emphasis on rush chances to generate offense, the Canucks don't have a player in the top 40 for points. It is interesting. I mean, that's one of the differences at this point of the calendar from this year as opposed to last season, right? Like, I think it was this time last year. It was right around the Bo Horvat return game where the Canucks were, what, 1, 2, 3, and maybe even 4 with Besser in points in the NHL. It was Patterson and Miller and Hughes right up at the top of the league. But I think that's instructive, too, that like individual goal scoring is not the metric you want to be using, or point scoring is not the metric you want to be using to evaluate a team's offensive punch, right? Because at this point last year, the Canucks had a bunch of guys top five in the NHL in scoring, and then we saw what their offensive generation looked like at the end of the playoffs, right? And even for large stretches of the back half of that season, they struggled to consistently generate chances and score goals. And so, you know, I think there's the point about like, okay, hey, that emphasis on rush chances to generate offense, has it really materialized? Is the identity of this team significantly different? I think we've seen it in moments. I'll also say, and this surprised me a little bit, right? I was looking at this in response to this text. Goals for per 60 at even strength. The Canucks are sixth in the NHL. 2.97 goals for per 60, and they've done that with a pretty normal shooting percentage, right around 10%, which is, you know, right around where everyone else in the top 10 is as well. So on the one hand, like, if you asked me, hey, have the Canucks been significantly more dangerous offensively through 14 games this year than they were last year, I probably would have said no. But if you look at what they've actually been able to do at even strength, it stacks up pretty well with the rest of the league.
Yeah, I mean, they're generating shots at an average rate. That's the key difference here. They're generating shots at an average rate. Last year, they were generating shots at the 26th yep. best rate in the league. There were no playoff teams except for the Washington Capitals, who made it with a historically low goal differential, that generated fewer shots 5-on-5 than the Canucks and made the playoffs. So the truth is that Vancouver ran so hot from a shooting percentage perspective that it warped our perception of what this team was offensively. Mm-hmm. In truth, they were a pop gun offense, and once they bumped into an elite team with their season on the line, they needed fantastic breakdowns, right? Well, Michael McLeod turning the puck over to generate anything.
Ryan McLeod.
What did I say?
Michael McLeod.
Ooh, excuse me, that's his brother. Ryan McLeod. I think this team has made a significant improvement in terms of the quality of their attacking game. It's just been hard to see through a small sample, in part because of how hot Vancouver ran offensively in the early part of last year, which clouded our perception of what this team's offensive ceiling was. The truth is that it was extraordinarily low and completely dependent on Quinn Hughes's minutes.
Mm.
This team generated nothing without Quinn Hughes on the ice. That's a problem. And by the way, that's a problem that's not fully fixed. That's still the area for growth here.
The other thing, too, about looking at the individual statistics is the power play has such a big role in that, right? Like the power play has a massive, massive role in that. And the power play is not clicking yet. It hasn't looked good. And that, you know, that was a big part of why all those guys last year through the first month, 6 weeks of the season got off to these incredible scoring numbers, is because the power play was really clicking early in this, in the year last year. But, you know, it is instructive because the team with the most impressive group of individual point producers right now is Colorado. Nathan McKinnon's leading the league in points. Mika Rantanen's fifth. Cale Makar also fifth with 25 points. Nathan McKinnon has 33 points. And yet...
he's on pace for 125 assists.
That's not bad. That's unreal. Just
casual.
Unreal. And they've needed them, to those guys, to be that good, because they are like in the bottom third of the league in goals for per 60 right now. Some of that is shooting percentage. They haven't been great, but their depth is obviously ravaged right now. They don't have a lot of it. And so they've needed, you know, those guys to be absolute studs, and they've needed the power play to work for them as well. But, you know, as I just think it's an interesting way of, yeah, you can be concerned maybe that, okay, Miller, Pettersson, even Hughes, not producing the raw statistical output that they were last year. So much of that was baked in, though. And if you actually look at the process the team has offensively, it looks a lot more encouraging this year than it did last year if they can keep it up.
It's pretty funny that they're still shooting 10% and at 5-on-5 and are among the top five teams in the league by shooting percentage, right? Like, to some extent, the fact that their production feels more pedestrian than last year really speaks to just how wild what we saw from this team last year was.
Truly wild.
Because it's still probably a little bit overheated. I mean, this team does have legitimate elite finishers, but they're still kind of on an offensive heater here. Like, they're definitely converting better than they did down the stretch last season.
Mm-hmm.
And there probably does hit a point this season, hopefully not when it really matters, where this club will shoot 7%, 8% for a stretch of games 5-on-5. Like, that's going to happen. And so even the idea that, hey, even that feeling, that perception that, hey, this team's not blowing teams out the same way they did last year, like, even that should be qualified somewhat by the fact that, hey, they've still probably been a little bit fortunate offensively.
Yeah, it's a lot different than it was last year, though, obviously, right? Like, last year, their shooting percentage was just so off the charts. And
last year, they were rivaling the Edmonton Oilers of the 80s in terms of some of what they were doing from a you know.
Yeah. This year, you know, you're right. I think they're sixth in the league in shooting percentage at 5-on-5. But if you also look at it, they're like, almost half of the league is within a percent of them either way. You know what I mean? So it's like they could cool off to 15th in the league and it wouldn't be that dramatic a difference as it would have been last year, where it was like, oh my gosh, they're just absolutely, they're rewriting the charts for these things literally over the course of a season. The rush thing, it feels like it's kind of gone on the back burner a little bit here over the last couple of weeks, but I think maybe we've just kind of chalked it up to, okay, they don't really have the blue line pieces to consistently do that. But do you kind of have a sense of, I mean, first of all, like, have they made progress from the beginning of the year in your eyes in being a more dangerous team off the rush?
Well, fitfully, right? I mean, I saw that Edmonton Oilers game as a big step back because they generated absolutely nothing in that game, period. You know, did I see enough against Calgary that it offset it? No, not really, right? Like, they mm-hmm. scored wonderful goals, but they weren't rush goals, right? You know, the game against Anaheim, I mean, Anaheim was so pathetic that it's hard. They just looked like they were on the power play all game, yeah. So it's hard for me to be like, that's a good sample of it. Against L.A., I thought they played really well. Like, I liked their game, but it felt a little more like the Canucks identity from last year than it did some, mm-hmm. you know, grand evolution. I thought there were signs early in the season that the team's sort of attacking verve and dynamism had leveled up a bit. I feel like I've seen fewer signs of that the last five game segment, but they've played well. So, you know, it's not an end in and of itself is sort of how I'd caption it, right? It's like, it's not enough for this team to be generating off the rush. The point is to generate off the rush and also maintain your defensive identity.
Yes.
And it feels like the last five or six games, this team's defensive robustness has largely returned. But has that come at the expense of some of the attacking progress we saw, right? It's just, we need more time. We need more time to see it.
I also think as much as the emphasis was specifically on the rush, and look, you want to be, to a certain extent, you want to be a balanced offensive team who can do a bunch of different things, right? You don't want teams to be able to key on one thing. But the greater concern for me was always just, okay, generating more high danger chances of any sort. If you can do it off the rush without sacrificing your defensive identity, that's great. But I also just want to see them more, maybe take more risks, create more dangerous chances when they're set up in the offensive zone as well. I do think we've been able to see the product of a higher baseline level of skill in the forward group, right? And maybe this is the difference between, you know, the rush stuff and the in-zone stuff, where the rush stuff relies on the blue line a little bit more to key it and jumpstart it and get the forwards going in the right direction. But, you know, like that Bluger, Heinen, Sherwood line on the third line, like they've made some impressive plays in the offensive zone. They've made some impressive plays off the rush as well. So I think you're starting to see a little of it, but it's more almost just because they improve the personnel at the bottom of the lineup rather than the team looks like they're playing tactically radically different. You know what I mean? Like, I don't think it's that, oh, they really reshaped what they want to do on offense as much as it is more minutes are going to guys who can make at least some decent plays out there in the offensive zone.
For the Canucks.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that's forward group. I think that's a big part of it, right? I mean, have you done the statistical deep dive on the production of all the forwards that
the ones that exited?
Yeah.
No, I haven't.
Have you not?
Is it ugly?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, no, it's really ugly. I mean, let's put this in the Elias Pettersson can't elevate his line mates file, okay? Andre Kuzmenko, 17 games, 1 goal, yeah. 8 assists, 9 points. Sam Lafferty, 15 games, 1 goal, 0 assists, 1 point. Ilya Mikheyev, 15 games, 1 goal, 1 assist.
Yeah.
I never want to hear that Pettersson can't elevate line mates again. Just never, never, like never say that. No one should ever say that ever again.
But yeah, and
like we all honestly owe Pettersson an apology. not me, but everyone else. No, truly, like the amount of riffraff.
Well, and Lafferty and
this team had playing top 6 minutes.
Lafferty and Mikheyev were like 6th and 7th in 5-on-5 minutes for this team at forward.
And Sam Lafferty had 10 goals by Christmas and 5 of them bounced in off his rear end. What? I'm not kidding.
It's true.
It was crazy. We've never seen anything like it. Honestly, yeah. not just we, hockey. Hockey has never seen a team run as hot as the Canucks did offensively. For large stretches of last season. You know, certainly in the last 25 years, like since the butterfly became commonplace, it was that spectacular. And you know what? It was hilarious.
It was.
Like, it was amazing.
It was fun to watch.
It was incredible. Honestly, it was incredible. Like, inimical. Like, we'll never see it again. It was fantastic.
But yeah, that point about just the, as you said, the kind of riffraff, the cardio guys out there for the Canucks.
The Justin Watsons.
Last year. It was, yeah, like, and it wasn't spot minutes. It wasn't like, oh, they're, you know, they're 10th and 11th most used forwards last year, right? Like it was, yeah, 5th and 7th. Ilya Mikheyev, 5th most 5-on-5 minutes for the Canucks last season at forward. Sam Lafferty, 7th. Most 5-on-5 minutes for the Canucks last year, right? Like they were healthy, they played a ton, and we all saw what it looked like in the back half of the season and then into the playoffs. And so not that, you know, Kiefer Sherwood and Danton Heinen are world beaters offensively, but it's just I think we maybe underestimated how much that floor got raised up a little bit by replacing those minutes with the new minutes.
Well, that's a big part of what's happened, without question. How about this for a stat, by the way? You ready?
Yeah.
Since the All-Star break last year, because it was really that All-Star break was like where the Magic Pixie Dust goal scoring kind of abandoned Vancouver. The Canucks have played 33 games, regular season only, so I'm not counting the playoffs, although these numbers would look probably even more pedestrian with the playoffs included, given that Vancouver didn't score a ton or generate many shots. The Canucks have scored 102 goals across 33 games.
Okay. But that's not from the All-Star game last season. They played more than 20 games after the All-Star break, didn't they? Or no?
Okay. Sorry. I've got a month. I have it in March, not February. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it. Okay. From the All-Star break last season. Let's try this again. Bleep bloop. Cue up the quick Dranstas research on air machine. Canucks have scored 140 goals in 47 games. So that's well under three a game.
Mm-hmm.
That's the 26th highest total in the, or 25th highest total in the league over that same stretch. All strengths, right? So, you know, that actually does kind of reflect their process.
Mm-hmm.
And their process has improved this season, right? The fact that they're generating shots at an average or better rate is important because I actually think that stretch probably more accurately reflects this team's offensive true talent level. It's a 47 game sample. It's not small.
Not nothing.
Than the 35 game sample where they were, you know, looking like the 1980s Edmonton Oilers. And so that's something that, you know, we talked about it a lot throughout last season. It was something that I kept insisting on. And it's why the club's approach to focusing on the rush and focusing on wing depth and, you know, not just bringing the band back together, but really seeking to raise the offensive ceiling of this team or the offensive floor, as you quite rightly point out, are such worthwhile endeavors, even if there's moments where it looks a little frustrating in the first 15, 20 games of the
year. Well, and I think the even strength part of that improvement is really important, right?
Yep.
Generating shots at the average rate at even strength, because it's such a dramatic improvement from what we saw last year. And it also really puts the power play in the spotlight, right? Like, if you're trying to build a formula for the team to go on a deep run, okay, if you can do, you know, average offense 5-on-5, elite defense, and a really dangerous power play, you don't want to rely on your power play too much, but like, okay, that starts to get pretty interesting, right? They're missing that part of it. You know what I mean? They've done a lot of the work raising the floor offensively at 5-on-5, but the power play has not been anywhere close to good enough. And if they're going to have the all situations scoring profile of a Stanley Cup contender, like, I don't think they're going to be a top five scoring team at 5-on-5. You know what I mean? It's going to have to come, at least part of it, from the power play. And I think the longer we go into the season here, that's going to be more and more in the spotlight of what can they do to make that a legitimate weapon? Because I don't think this is a team that can have a bad power play and kind of survive and find ways around it and still go on a deep run.
Yeah, they're still somehow 14th in the league by power play conversion rate. They're still over 20%. And yet every time the Canucks get a power play opportunity, you feel like it's going to be a bit of good fortune if they score. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, it doesn't feel dangerous. And it certainly hasn't performed at a level where it creates consistent momentum.
No.
Which I also think matters a ton.
It doesn't feel like a weapon.
That said, I will say, I do think they're moving the puck more directly the last, like, 10
yep.
days. I've seen a lot of progress, I think, since sort of the nadir, which was the loss to the Devils. Right, that at the loss to the Devils, the power play looked so hopeless. They gave up the shorthanded goal. Like, it was brutal to watch. And then against the Sharks, they had they didn't score, but they had an opportunity, and it was like all of the, like, dawdling at the flanks was gone. It was just like far more direct, far more purposeful, far more intentional puck movement. I feel like that's been sustained now for a segment of five games. I like to see it. I haven't checked to see if the stats match my eye test there, but I you know, that's my view of it based on what we're seeing. And I think that's good. Like, I think that's a sign of progress. But yeah, I mean, you know, I think we can honestly start thinking about this from the perspective of, like, a for the playoffs shopping list, right? The Canucks are second in the Pacific by point percentage. They haven't even played that great. Demko's been out. They're getting Joshua's first game tonight. They're dealing with an uncertain injury timeline on Besser. Hasn't mattered. This team's still getting really good results. Like, we kind of know what this team is going to be. And we're just sort of in a holding pattern discussing, like, what matters big picture now for months and months. And for Canucks management, that means you're probably in a spot where you're beginning to feel a little bit comfortable. Maybe at some point you make a move to reinforce something kind of like they did with Zadorov after Soucy got hurt. But for the most part, I think you're taking the long view. You're tolling as much cap space as you can, and you're thinking about what you need to make a long playoff run. I mean, I think that's where this club is kind of positioned, which, by the way, that's a fun place to be positioned.
And it's why, despite some of the concerns about form, the fact that they're 8-3-3 is a big deal.
Yes,
because you
sure.
don't have to do anything more than that, right?
No.
You're like, hey, we're sitting totally fine in the standings.
We're doing well.
We have a baseline that allows us to win games.
It's a long season.
Let's take that long view, right?
Yes.
Like, that's what 8-3-3 allows you to do.
But I do think as we sort of think about and consider like a Canucks shopping list
mm-hmm.
to upgrade this team for the playoffs, like, I do still sort of think right-handed power play weapon needs to be included. Does it need to be included as like if the headline is top four upgrade, which it is, by the way, and the subheader is right-handed face-off winner, then I think the nut graph of the article should be
the picture caption.
Yeah, exactly. Should be, you know, and a right-handed shot that can contribute on the power play. And look, if you're lucky, you'll find another guy who both wins, draws, and can help you on the power play by being, you know, a right-handed finisher. That's not an easy piece to find, but they did find it last year in Elias Lindholm. So
they did.
You know, like, he did both.
Yeah. That was a good pickup, at least for the playoffs.
Remember how
low the market was on him going into the playoffs?
Yeah, he was.
It was wild how much it flipped.
He was good in the playoffs, but he didn't drive play.
No.
You know, so I don't know. I mean, I thought Lindholm was an awesome fit.
All right, we're going to leave it there for today. The Canucks take on...
I miss watching him hound puck carriers in the neutral zone. That was fun as heck. He was awesome at that.
Bo Horvat back in town again with the New York Islanders. They take on the Canucks at Rogers Arena tonight. We're back tomorrow with a Friday edition of the show. Enjoy the game tonight. We'll catch you tomorrow here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650.